I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Thursday, August 5th. Our guest is Westchester and Rockland Congressman Mondaire Jones. We'll talk to the congressman about some of the big national politics developments this week, including, centrally, President Biden's decision to announce a new two-month eviction moratorium, but only after progressives reacted so angrily to his decision to let the old eviction moratorium lapse after the U.S. Supreme Court struck it down. Mondaire Jones, who graduated Harvard Law School in 2013, is now a freshman in a much less prestigious organization, the United States Congress. Just kidding. Okay, not kidding. Congressman Jones, great to have you on again. Welcome back to WNYC.
Brian, it's so great to be back.
I was kidding, not kidding, you know, about what it means to be in Congress these days. What's your experience so far with how people you meet react to your membership in that body, as opposed to, say, being from Harvard Law or working in the Obama Justice Department, as you also did?
More than anything, I'm proud to have grown up in Section 8 housing and on food stamps, and to be bringing that perspective of someone who understands what it's like to struggle in this broken economy and to face housing insecurity, which is a lens that was very helpful in my recent advocacy that turned out to be successful in getting the president to issue a new moratorium with respect to evictions. It has been a dream to serve the people of Westchester and Rockland County in the United States Congress. And I do not lose sight of the fact that it is a privilege. It's something that's very humbling, and it's something that causes me to work very hard every single day, along with an incredible group of people known as my staff, who care and who share my values and who work just as hard.
And as I say, we'll get to the Cuomo stuff, but to the eviction moratorium. And yeah, I know you were involved with Congresswoman Cori Bush's protest to get President Biden to issue this new national eviction moratorium through October 3rd. I want our listeners to hear about 45 seconds of Congresswoman Bush the other day.
Representative Ocasio-Cortez and I, when we found out that that we had been recessed, and that people were already on planes, people were going on vacation, people were going back home, I couldn't understand, my brain, my heart could not understand how we leave 11 million people, how we leave 6 million families just in a place of not knowing what to do and possibly being forced out of their homes. It's still to this moment, I can't figure that out. And so I remember just saying, well, I have to do something, like something has to happen. And I reached in my own toolbox. Somebody else may have done something different, but what I know to do is to put your body on the line. And so that's what I did.
So what happened there, Congressman, as you see it, including when she refers to Congress having been recessed and she couldn't believe it? Did Nancy Pelosi send you all home when she should have stayed and objected to President Biden's non-extension of the eviction moratorium? And what does this all say to you about President Biden's commitment to bold progressive action in general?
I think the context is important. On about Thursday of last week, we were notified, and when I say we, I mean Congress, by the White House, that it was the White House's expectation that Congress would, through legislation, issue a new moratorium for purposes of keeping as many as 11 million people securely housed in this country. We were, of course, set to go on recess the following day, Friday. And over the course of approximately 24 hours, Speaker Pelosi worked very diligently to see if she had the votes for that legislation. But unfortunately, there wasn't enough time to make the case to a handful of Democrats who were at the time not persuaded that it was something we needed to do for whatever reason. Of course, the entire time, the White House had the authority to extend the eviction moratorium that it had previously extended through executive action, through an instruction to the CDC that it do precisely that. And so it was an artificially made crisis. And it's why people like myself and Cori Bush and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and so many other people stayed for several days out on the Capitol steps, in many instances sleeping overnight, raising this issue in the public consciousness, and ultimately successfully getting the White House to do what it did not want to do, but what it had the authority to do, which is issue a new moratorium.
Here's a clip of President Biden from Tuesday announcing the eviction moratorium, but referring to the Supreme Court decision that scared him off from doing that in the first place.
Whether that option will pass constitutional measure with this administration, I can't tell you. I don't know. There are a few scholars who say it will, and others who say it's not likely to. But at a minimum, by the time it gets litigated, it will probably give some additional time while we're getting that $45 billion out to people who are, in fact, behind in the rent and don't have the money.
President Biden on Tuesday. So, Congressman Jones, for you as a lawyer and former Justice Department staffer, what would you say to a court to defend the new moratorium? The other side would say, and they even refer to the president's statement there, I guess, they'd say, look, in June, the Supreme Court said that the executive branch cannot do this on its own. It needs Congress to pass a longer eviction moratorium. The ruling was very clear. What would your counterargument be for the constitutionality of this 2 month extension?
I would start by clarifying for the court that the Supreme Court never did that. It was a non-binding, lone opinion by Brett Kavanaugh that predicted that the Supreme Court in the future would not uphold an eviction moratorium, which is why I took issue with the White House press release suggesting that there had been a Supreme Court opinion suggesting otherwise. More importantly, Congress has appropriated over $46 billion for purposes of rental assistance, for purposes of making landlords whole, right? We want landlords to get the money that Congress has already appropriated for this purpose. And we want renters to be able to avoid homelessness. And that is precisely what can be done if states like New York would speed up the process of dispersing those funds. New York is sitting on over $2 billion that it has not dispersed to renters in desperate need of assistance that Congress, again, has already allocated for this specific purpose.
But that's an Albany failure, right? That would almost argue that there doesn't need to be a longer-term eviction moratorium until the funds from this one get distributed.
Well, the problem is that as we wait for Governor Cuomo to disperse these funds, people, if the eviction moratorium is allowed to lapse, as it did temporarily, because it expired on Saturday night before a new one was issued, days later after our advocacy, if during that period money is not dispersed, those folks could find themselves out on the streets. That's why, to the president's point, it was important to issue a new moratorium for the purpose of providing temporary relief, allowing additional time for the governor to disperse these funds.
From the Chew on the Other Foot department, I can only imagine what Democrats would say if after a Supreme Court justice said that one of President Trump's policies, maybe his border wall funding without Congress authorizing the money, had been, you know, just characterized the way Justice Kavanaugh characterized this, and Trump had said, no, I'm going to extend it anyway under a different name. Would you have considered that a constitutional crisis, the executive branch defying a Supreme Court opinion and one that protected the authority of the congressional branch, no less, to make law under the separation of powers?
Well, look, I don't want to, you know, accept a premise that is untrue, right? The fact is there was no, in this case, Supreme Court opinion, not a majority opinion that said that an extension of the eviction moratorium would be unconstitutional. And by the way, I think the president probably should have mentioned this as an issue of statutory interpretation and not one of constitutionality. So I do think he misspoke, but the point is similar. It is possible that at some point the Supreme Court will, for the first time, issue a majority opinion striking down the moratorium as unconstitutional. But that is no reason not to try to keep people securely housed as states hopefully speed up the process of dispersing tens of billions of dollars across this nation to people who desperately need these funds and for whom Congress has already allocated the money.
What do you want Speaker Pelosi to do next? Do you need now in Congress to pass an even longer eviction moratorium? Because I think it's fair to say with the Delta variant, the crisis is not going to be over on October 3rd. I presume it's going to be difficult to get it through the Senate with the gridlock there. But do you think it's important for the House with its Democratic majority to pass an extension if you have the votes?
I'm so grateful to you for the opportunity to talk about the fact that this poses a public health crisis, right? I mean, we know that the Delta variant is surging. And if you are not persuaded by arguments about the humanity of everyone, you know, and the entitlement for people to be able to live in dignity in the richest nation in the world, the fact is 11 million people out in the streets is going to exacerbate the ongoing pandemic. And so I do support reconvening as a Congress for the purpose of legislative action. And, you know, there's obviously a great difficulty over in the Senate with the filibuster being intact, which is why I've called on the White House to support reforming the filibuster. My preference would be to get rid of it altogether. But at a minimum, there should be reform to the filibuster to allow legislation in the best interest of the American people, like what we're talking about.
You've called on the Senate to end the filibuster. You also, I know, as a candidate last year, supported Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. And you were outspoken about expanding the Supreme Court. We're talking about this as hanging on the opinion of one justice. You talk about expanding the Supreme Court from its current 9 seats. Is that idea alive anymore politically, or just a talking point after the Republicans kind of stole 2 seats, even though they kind of stole 2 seats under Trump and Mitch McConnell?
I can assure you it is not a talking point. Not so long as our democracy remains in crisis. And the Supreme Court, of course, has had a significant role to play in getting us to this point. The Supreme Court, as of a decision a few weeks ago called Brnovich, has all but dismantled the crown jewel of the civil rights movement, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Section 2 in that Brnovich decision was essentially gutted. And we know that the preclearance provision was gutted in the 2013 Shelby decision, which opened the floodgates for the voter suppression that we've seen in places like Georgia and Florida and Arizona. So we are facing a crisis, and the Supreme Court is part of the solution. Reforming the Supreme Court is necessary to protect the fundamental right to vote in this country. The Roberts Court has not seen a voter suppression law that it has struck down as unconstitutional. That is remarkable. And also speaks to the fact that we have a now 6-3 far-right majority on the court that is hostile to democracy itself. And we know what happens when people are not allowed to vote in this country. You get a party of insurrectionists, of people who don't want to certify presidential elections, of people who don't have policy proposals, but who feel threatened by a changing America, winning national elections that they should not be able to win if everyone in this country is allowed to vote. It is a distortion of our democracy that people like Marjorie Taylor Greene are winning elections.
By the way, do you have a certain model for expanding the court? I know there are different ones intended, for example, to depoliticize the court, like 15 justices, of which the president appoints 5, Congress appoints 5, and the 10 justices themselves appoint the other 5. Do you have a preferred model?
On Thursday, April 15th of this year, joined by the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, and the chair of the Subcommittee on Courts, Hank Johnson, I introduced the Judiciary Act of 2021, which would add 4 seats to the Supreme Court. It would restore balance to a court who, as you mentioned, whose several seats have been stolen. We saw that after Justice Scalia died, Mitch McConnell literally left a vacancy for 14 months based on a non-existent rule that he then went back on when he rushed through the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett following the tragic death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Why 4 seats, and who gets to appoint him?
With 4 additional seats added to the Supreme Court, you will once again have a majority on the court that is committed to American democracy, that will protect the fundamental right to vote, which is preservative of all other rights. So this isn't about Republicans versus Democrats, as I think I mentioned the last time I was on this show, before I had introduced the bill. We know that Republican judges in the past, you know, Justices Souter and Stevens, were very supportive of the right to vote and voted to uphold the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. But that is not the case of the Roberts Court today, not the Roberts Court majority.
Let me play you a clip of civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton on MSNBC's Morning Joe today, commenting broadly on black voters being often more moderate, quote unquote, in their choices than progressives would prefer, like supporting Eric Adams for mayor of New York or Joe Biden for president in the pivotal South Carolina primary last year. Listen.
A lot of the latte liberals, as I call them, act like what is it, that blacks in South Carolina are stupid? Or are they saying, no, we're voting our interests where they're practical? You can't, in race after race after race, see the majority of black voters, particularly black women, brown voters, vote against a lot of what they're talking about and act like for some reason they don't have enough sense to rise to their intellectual level. No, maybe they reject it because they have to practically raise families in situations that are disadvantaged and disproportionately not getting the goods and services that other communities are getting. And they rather have practical, prudent, progressive politicians rather than people that want to dream at their expense.
People who want to dream at their expense. What's your reaction to that as a black man and a stated progressive, and the implications there that latte liberals, you know, mean many of the progressive wing leaders are white and out of touch?
You know, as you know, I don't represent any portion of New York City, but I've got family members who voted for Eric Adams. And the fact is, black people are not monolithic. The black community is not monolithic in the way that no community is monolithic. People want to feel safe in their communities. These same people also don't want to be brutalized because of how they look. And both things can be true. And I think nuance is important. And I think that additional nuance is probably required within the progressive movement, of which I'm a proud member. And I'm looking forward to continuing to make that case as well.
Charles in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Congressman Mondaire Jones. Hi, Charles.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Brian. I just wanted to say that I just feel that sometimes the black community gets attacked or becomes part of a, part of something that they're not a part of. Like when Cuomo had all of these sex accusations brought up against him during COVID, he immediately goes to the black community and gets his virus shot. And it's almost like the community is all right with that, all right with him, and they're really not. But it's his voice is louder, and the black community gets carried into it. And I just think that politicians just stay away from that because we get dragged into it when we're not a part of it. And they, you know, their voices weren't heard. His was. That's basically all I wanted to say.
What do you think, Charles, if you want to continue, about the sort of larger pattern here that we touched on before, you know, when there were progressive challengers to Cuomo in the last 2 Democratic primaries for governor, black voters supported him solidly, plus the Eric Adams thing, plus the Joe Biden thing?
I think that until this, all the allegations just built up, like there were many things that Cuomo was doing that, you know, I wouldn't agree with, you know, like putting the motorcycle, I mean, those motor bicycles in the park and on the streets when, if you need exercise, you need to pedal the bike, not have a motor on it. There's just a lot of things that I think he did that were whacked, let's just say that. You know, like when all these allegations came, like he finally decided to tax people that were rich. You know, like as your senator said, he, all these things brought him to stand up to the plate, but he's been like a loose cannon in some ways, and every, you know, now it's just hit the ceiling. And every time I feel that the black community is being carried into it, I don't think Biden is in that category at all. And I think that Cuomo stands alone by himself.
Charles, thank you so much for your call. And certainly Biden not in that category when it comes to scandal. But Congressman, why do you think Cuomo has found so much solace and political insulation, at least until now? We'll see if it changes, among black New Yorkers and black New York leaders.
I think he has a lot of validators in the black community, and that the impression of the governor has been created in part by a failure of political leadership in the rest of New York State to really call him out when he has failed the black community and various other communities. Look, this is someone who, if you've been paying attention to politics, a lot of people were afraid of until very recently. And in that kind of environment, it's difficult to hear alternative voices.
Congressman Mondaire Jones from the district in Central and Western Westchester and all of Rockland County, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us and answering calls from our listeners. It's always great when you come on, and we hope you keep coming back lots of times.
Thanks so much. I'll be back.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.